Hi, this is Robin, and I'm hoping you're warm and cozy, enjoying a little bit of downtime here in the middle of winter, which, in my book, is getting an A+ as far as showing what winter is, cold and snowy. Today we've got two guests. Fourth-generation farmer Sherry Copathorn Barnes is ranching at her family's CL Ranches out of Calgary in Canada, with a focus in raising environmentally compatible animals. Sherry's got the skinny on raising cattle in temperatures that not only dip into minus 40 Fahrenheit, but stay in those minus double digits for extended periods of time. I've also been able to catch up with Josiah Hunt, CEO at Pacific Biochar, where they are at the forefront of bringing biochar into the 21st century in a most sustainably technological way. So grab your earbuds and or most likely a snow shovel, and let's dig in for Cultivated Audio, January 2023. Sherry, give us a brief on CL Ranches.
You bet. Well, my great-grandfather established CL Ranches back in 1887, and we are located straight west of Calgary, Alberta, kind of halfway in between Calgary and Banff, if you've been to Banff, so that kind of gives you an idea where we're at. He established in this area because he felt it looked most like Ireland for some reason, and so I don't think he was ever here in the wintertime to figure that out, but that's how we ended up being where we were, right. As he ended up being, his brother came out ahead of him and did a lot of trading with the Northwest Mounted Police and our First Nations up here and actually learned the language and was one of their first translators, and so really got a good feel for what this land was like at that time. Today, we operate on a variety of deeded lands, as well as our crown leases up here, as well as I have a number of extended family members that are holding on to their land bases because we are so close to Calgary, but don't want to necessarily release it. So I'm on a lot of different types of leases and joint ventures and things like that is with them. And our acreage up here can vary from about 16,000 acres to 28,000 acres on a good year. So we just kind of ebb and flow with what the year brings. And we do that with a combination of cattle because we are definitely we have a seed stock here, herd here, as well as a backgrounding lot. So we'll background calves, do quite a bit of custom farming for a lot of folks. And as well, we'll bring in some pairs in the summertime when we do get that extra summer grazing.
Can you give us an example of the back grazing that you do?
Mostly we're right in the foothills of the mountains, of the Rocky Mountains here. And so really a lot of it, it's not quite intensive because up here we also only have about a 90-day growing season. So we do some rotational grazing, intensive rotational grazing on improved croplands or cover crops or things like that with our yearlings. But the cow-calves, this country is beautifully designed for just turning cows loose on the hills and rotating them via moving salt blocks or just kind of opening gates and pushing them through. They'll follow the water as the water dries up as well. So because we've been here over 130 years, we kind of know how this land ebbs and flows depending on what the climate's like. And we're able to take advantage of that just by knowing where to have the cattle and when.
Yes. Now, in the 60s, CL Ranches started with herds of mainly horned Hereford cattle, and then you moved into what you've just mentioned, the CL Supercross Seed Stock Cattle Breeding Program. Can you share a bit about that and some points about why you did this? And of course, it's to match what's going on with the land and the geography and temperatures and all of that.
You bet. The genetics that we have been developing over the past couple of generations really are based, not married to a herd, but looking at the traits that the cattle possess. And we are really trying to match the most efficient animal to the environment that we have. When you're dealing with only a 90-day growing season, you've got to find cows that can handle foraging as best they can in very dormant seasons. We're literally could potentially in times be feeding 180 days of the year. So you can't afford to feed a cow a whole bunch. So we watch for the traits within the specific breeds that will allow them to be strong foragers. But at the same time, if you remember, I also have a backgrounding lot. I recognize that these cattle have to go into a feedlot and finishing scenario as well. And because grass finishing can be quite expensive up here because of that, we try to, we need the size in these cattle too. So you balance that foraging ability as well as making sure you've got a large enough carcass there to be able to sell into the commodity market as well if need be.
So what are some breeds that you use and what have you found to be most successful?
It's always evolving. We did definitely started out with the horned Herefords way back when. And actually before that, it was more of a shorthorn type cross because we, believe it or not, started out as a dairy farm. But it's been evolving from there. With the Herefords, they crossed in the 70s. We crossed in some Simmental as well as some Bronve. I had an next-door neighbor and a cousin that was one of our top Bronve breeders here in Canada. That brought in, we had to bring in that Bronve more than anything for pigmentation because we were getting sunburned udders in the snow and things like that and pink eye. So that really helped. But with that also brought the Simmental and the Bronve together, brought in a lot of marbling, but a lot of size. And it was too big. And so then we had to kind of start to downsize. And I hate to say this to your audience, but my father, for some reason, has a little bit of a prejudice against Angus. And so we looked and searched for something that was going to be similar to the Angus-like characteristics that all our packers and consumers are wanting. And we were able to find that in a breed called Sussex. So we brought in some bulls and started breeding and crossbreeding with the Sussex, which is an ancient British breed coming out of Europe. Very, very similar to the Red Angus. And we're able to downsize that animal. And one of the side benefits was that these Sussex are a very good forager. And they will fatten very efficiently and effectively on this grass. But they got too small over the years as well. So we had to start to bring back a little bit more. And so I was able to kind of break through some of my father's prejudices. And we've been looking at a couple of the different Angus lines these days. Because you sure can't ignore that from the marketing capacity.
Yes. And it's quite a joke, isn't it, to think, oh, we found the perfect formula.
Yeah, exactly.
For any aspect.
And it does. It ever evolves. So it's something that it's a living journey. And you just keep watching and seeing. I mean, from my perspective, it is about understanding and making sure that you're dealing with bull clients that have the information and are managing in a similar way that we are, really watching for that ability to maintain that cow size. It's something that's reasonable to this area because we do not feed grains whatsoever to our cows.
Wonderful. Is there a benefit you're seeking in your breeding program that has kind of been elusive up to this point, or are you always making your mark and then knowing you're keeping an eye on things and seeing where it all goes?
I don't think that we've ever had any trait that has been very elusive. I think we've been able to find what we want. The problem is with breeding is that it's a typical bell curve. You find what you want, you target it, and then all of a sudden, if you don't keep refreshing it, you'll lose that average, or the market will change. And so it's a matter of always looking at the economics, because at the end of the day, this is a business,
yes.
Making sure that these cattle remain cost-effective, but it's at the same time still finding that animal that can handle this tough environment, but will finish into that market, because at the end of the day, it's about the pounds of beef produced.
Right, yes, and I did originally get in touch with you, Sherry, to speak about not cold weather cattle ranching, but freezing weather cattle ranching.
Yeah.
And of course, your basic job is observing your herd every single day, regardless of the weather. But what's involved in supporting the cattle in the depths of winter? How do you keep their furnace stoked? And what signs do you look for to make sure they're remaining healthy?
You bet. I mean, for us, again, it all stems back to that genetic selection, too, because there's definitely lines of cattle that don't do as well, and that has everything to do with the amount of back fat that they can carry on these forage diets, as well as the hair length. Hair length is absolutely critical to keep these animals warm. When you see these cows walking around in October, November up here, and they're not starting to get really shaggy looking, then you know you've got problems, and it shows in their production for the following year. So we're constantly monitoring their body condition score. At the time, they only come through the chute once a year up here, and that's October and November when they're being preg checked. And it's at that point we will decide whether they're going to make it through the winter or not. This is a typical year where, I mean, before Christmas we saw, and it doesn't matter if it's centigrade or Fahrenheit, we were in minus 40 for about 2 weeks. And that was definitely early. We see those temperatures once or twice or three times in a winter. And what that does, unfortunately, is it sets these cows off on a plane, because once you start feeding cows, you have to keep feeding cows.
Mm.
They have been designed, God made a perfect animal when it comes to internal combustion with their digestive system. And so it does help keep them warm, but it's up to us to make sure that they've got the shelter that they need to be able to get in out of the winds, if there's any wind that's a part of that. Because, again, we do our very best not to supplement these cows with any form of energy. So as we head into the winter, we do have bales stockpiled everywhere. We take these cows to specific areas that where that feed is stored, as well as where that shelter exists. And the interesting part is I get people touring out here all the time, and especially from out east, that say, well, where are all your barns? And what I can show them is that we have spruce trees and pine trees that literally the cattle go under, and it's better than a barn because, of course, the first branches are right at their back length or back height. So they literally will go under these trees, and there's lots of protection under there. The interesting thing about where we're at here is we don't necessarily get a lot of deep snow because we get these Chinook winds, these west winds.
Mm, yes.
But what that does is that when you get a foot of snow, which we did get in October, it ices down. And so that's actually even worse than if you had 2 to 3 feet of snow in cases, because cows just can't break through it. And so it forces us to make sure that these cattle are able to get the forage that we need them. And we're stuck with having to deliver the feed to them with our tractors because of that fact. So it is a bit of a high cost with us. And that's why, again, the efficiency on what these cows eat is so critical, because of just where we're at. One of the other issues that I have out here, which is a little bit unique to the area, but, I mean, at any given time, I have no less than about 1,200 to 1,500 head of elk running around here. And so you can't leave feed out either, and so because the elk will just decimate any stockpiling of feed that you try to do. And once they've hit it, the cows don't like eating it. So we have to make sure that our feed is also being stored in a way that keeps it in the best condition possible for those cattle. Because when it does hit to 30 to 40 below, you got to make sure that they're eating the best of what they can eat.
Right, and the protein is so key, isn't it? Is it needed to digest the fiber, and then, of course, it sets the whole furnace rolling and keeping things warm?
You got it, yeah. The hay that we make around here, believe it or not, isn't extremely high in protein. It's usually anywhere from 9 to 11%. But that's an average. That's what our grasses do. Our grasses in the summertime will hit 14 to 16%, but the hay when it cures down is about 9 to 11. And this is where you find that different lines of genetics can handle that type of feed. The energy that goes with it, the TDNs are anywhere from, I'm going to say, probably from 55 to 65%. So they're pretty good, but they're not as high as what a grain would be. And that's all they're going to get. There will be times in some of the younger groups that will supplement with some green feed, which is the baled oats and barley, and that just helps keep them through. But honestly, they like the hay better than the green feed because usually it's too stocky. But it's just a matter of making sure that you've got enough fiber in their rumens that they're generating the heat coupled with the appropriate amount of protein that's required to get them through those days.
Yes, and I was naive, or I'm just not experienced with this, to say the least, and I was surprised at what a story their manure tells you as far as how they're doing.
Absolutely. I mean, the manure is critical because the other battle in all this when it's that cold is making sure they're also eating it, drinking enough water.
Yes.
I mean, there's lots of folks out there that believe that they can survive on snow. But again, our biggest issue here is that icing down problem. And you can't be guaranteed that the cows can even break through that snow. So it's imperative that in these winter feeding fields that you've got appropriate amounts of water. That helps at least establish how the health of that animal is doing, and making sure that they're getting that fiber processing through their system, because it will slow down if they don't have appropriate amounts of water. The manure, like if it's piling up in little pellets like elk and deer manure, then you know you're in trouble.
Yes, yes.
And that color will also will signify a lot as to how they're processing and what shape they're in. But, you know, honestly, in the wintertime and the cow herds, I can tell more by their coat hair, by the if there's steam coming off their back, if they're milling around and really trying to, like when you know that they should be bedding down and they're out scrounging for feed. There's other signs as well that are more critical than even what the manure looks like at that point.
Yes, and And to see them with that snow on their back, that's actually a very good sign, isn't it?
Absolutely. You want to see frost and you want to see snow on their back, because when it's 20, 30 below, that means that there's no heat escaping, that their back fat is actually acting like the insulation in your home, and it's keeping that heat inside. When that steam starts rising, or when that snow and it's that cold, if it starts disappearing, you know you've got an animal that's losing heat and there's something wrong and you need to act.
And what do you do? What do you think is going on when you see that?
You know, it's interesting because a lot of times what it is that for some reason they're definitely fighting a fever. And then they get to a point, if it's a low, 9 times out of 10, it's a cow that's in poor condition and she just doesn't have the back fat that's needed. In those cases, we'll have to bring them in and bring them into the feedlot and try and revive them and get them going again. But the reality is that cow will never turn around. Like once they've gotten to that point, they never recuperate.
Mm. Well, Sherry, cattle have their instincts for surviving the cold as well, and you mentioned they will just automatically go to the trees. Are there other things you've witnessed and learned from watching them as far as how their instincts are working?
The other thing that you can watch, like we do take feed samples, and we know more or less what they're being fed. I've got a group of young cows right now. I'll separate my cows by their age because they do have different nutrient requirements. Like I can feed the worst of the worst feed to my old girls and they're happier than I'll get out. But my second and third calvers, I'm watching them right now, having gone through, like right now we're going through some tremendous temperature spikes. Like one day, we woke up to 1 degree this morning, this is Fahrenheit, 1 degree this morning, and by tomorrow it's supposed to be as high as 25 to 30 degrees mm-hmm. Fahrenheit. Like, I mean, it's just, we're seeing some fluctuations that come with these Chinook winds that's really hard on these animals. And my young cows, right now, ahead of this Chinook coming in, yesterday and today, we've seen that they're pacing, they're unhappy, they look like they're harving, but they're hungry, but they're actually getting more feed than they should ever require. So you can tell when these system changes are coming in just because of the way they're behaving. Mm-hmm. And they're unsettled and they don't like it because the pressure changes do affect how they feel, and no different than many people up here get migraines at the same time. So you can tell that things are happening. But if you watch the cattle, they'll tell you more or less what's happening. I call it environmental awareness. And
yes.
The cattle, when you watch the cattle, you watch the wildlife, they do the same thing. And it's just about watching for the signs. Your insurance factor is knowing that you've got sufficient feed, you've got sufficient or working water systems that are not going to fail you when it's 40 below. I mean, when it hit, there was one morning here, we had wind chills of 51 below, and we did lose some water systems, but we have the tools to get them going again. Like, there's nothing you can do to prepare for that kind of temperature other than making sure you have enough feed and you have the tools necessary to keep it going so your cattle aren't suffering for more than 12 or 8 hours or whatever you can get through with it.
What's the go-to tools that you use?
It depends on what the water system is. Most of the cribbings were the ones that gave us the problem. We have many free-flowing wells here that just come straight out of the ground in through a tire trough and then back out again. Mm. Believe it or not, those are not the ones that plug up. Those ones plug up when we get these warm spells. It's the opposite because they get ice chunks as the weather starts to warm.
Oh, yes.
When it's really, really cold, it's our cribbing, our piping that starts to freeze up. And those, of course, you just need steam and heat and various tools like that. So,
right. Now, what are some of the positive aspects you've seen in the land itself that confirms that you are doing things in a sustainable and regenerative manner?
Remember that comment of the 12 to 1,500 head elk? Honestly, my wildlife are the indicator there as much as anything. We do monitor the soils. I test a lot of my fields for the soil test just to see where they're at, as well as we try to discover, I mean, what is the carbon sequestration capability of a lot of this native grassland under these trees and things like that. So there is some monitoring that's going on, without a doubt. But to me, it is watching where the wildlife want to go naturally. Elk have the same diet as a cow. And if they're inclined to be on certain fields, you know you've done a good job of keeping the grass and the varieties at the right levels, because I can't keep them out. It is a competition, which makes it tough.
Yes.
And
yes.
I mean, and you're always constantly watching the species and protecting the species, especially with the cattle, to make sure you're not overgrazing. Where you get these big herds of elk and deer, they'll come in and take out, especially like even in my tame grass pastures, they take out alfalfa in a matter of a couple years because they'll graze it right down. They're like sheep and they'll graze right down to the crown, and there's a lot of winter kill that goes on because of the wildlife as well. It's a double-edged sword.
Sure, yes. And Sherry, you are a founding chair of the Canadian Roundtable for Sustainable Beef. What benefits have you seen as a result of this organization?
That's been an interesting journey. And the reason I joined that and really tried to help spearhead that was because as I started to listen to the companies that are buying our meat, I found out that they actually really had the same kind of goals, or they were asking for the information that many of us ranchers were already doing. We just didn't have anything formalized to be able to hand over and say, here, take a look. See, this is what we're doing. And this is how we validate what I'm telling you. And so what it was really about coming together with the entire beef value chain, trying to figure out what it was that they needed, firstly, what we were going to define as being a sustainable product. And then figuring out, okay, with everything that we're already doing, how do we fit that into some kind of a framework or an ability to be able to monitor and measure so that you could validate that through a marketing system? Because, of course, if you want to market something, you've got to have a verified system in place so that there's no question about what you're doing. And many of our producers felt very threatened by that because they knew they were doing the right thing, and they are doing the right thing. It was about how we communicate that we're doing that right thing in a way that becomes a tangible marketing attribute. And so it's been a learning, steep learning curve, without a doubt, because many of these companies are so far-reaching as to they're setting their goals of what they would like to see for greenhouse gas emissions, for example. And there's a lot of tools and a lot of questions that they have that we just simply don't have because of economics and size and efficiency and,
of course, yes,
like that. But by having that open line of communication, hopefully we're able to help them understand that there's some things we simply can't deliver right now, but they've got to also know that we're constantly always looking to improve on what we're doing. And that's the main advantage of this is being able to show that we are active in this arena and not sitting back on our laurels and trying to make sure that we're doing our best to maintain and enhance the environment around us.
Must be frustrating to not have those answers and yet know, look, we're doing this. We've been doing this for a while now.
Very much so, because especially in the case of our policymakers, they want to see changes going forward. They're not willing to look what's happened in the past. And as I can tell you, as a fourth generation rancher, my great-grandfather, especially my grandfather, started us on a great path, but that doesn't seem to count. So there's pieces of this that are very frustrating, because when you've been doing it right for so long and you have no way to prove it, and yet you're being told you have to change in order to qualify for being sustainable going forward, it's constantly a battle to make sure that they understand that's the type of a scenario where it's great to be able to sit down at a table and really discuss it. And more importantly, you got to bring them out. They got to see the land. They got to see your cattle. You can't do this around a boardroom table. So it's about having your place open up enough that you can show what's happening at the same time.
Aside from the policymakers, of course, the public actually want clean meat. They're getting well educated, and it's thanks to farmers and ranchers like yourself that are really bringing this availability, not only bringing it, but sharing that, yes, it's here, it has been here, and we are part of that. It's a great movement that you're involved in, and I want to thank you for that, for sure.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You bet. I mean, when I first started out, the amazing part was that, like, I've been at this since probably about 2008, I want to say, and in those days, I mean, we thought that the solution, people would just Google something and research it and be able to see it. But the reality is we had no idea that you could pay to have your answer at the top of that Google list. If you didn't have the right list or the right information high enough, you were losing already. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this whole social media concept and internet of the ability to communicate across our phones and things like that, it has become a very integral part of what we do. And I'm very thankful there's a number of people in this industry that know way more than I do about how how to do that really well.
I'm sure there are many farmers and ranchers like yourself that never thought they'd be asked to be in articles and podcasts and workshops and all of that when the farmers and ranchers used to just be on the farm, and now it's such a huge movement that's going on.
That's exactly right, because our main consumers have lost connection to the land. And so as you try to right the wrongs, I guess, and really the wrongs are a lack of communication, it's tough because you realize you now only get 2 to 3 second sound bites or quick snippet videos to catch their attention, and the damage has been done. And so we have a long way to get back, and I think we're doing a good job of that. And I think marketing, the sales numbers themselves prove that people still have confidence in beef. So it's about ensuring that we continue reaching those audiences and reaching especially the children through education, that beef is a balanced part of this whole ecosystem, including their diet.
Yes.
And I think we saw proof of that in these latest COP27 discussions in Egypt as well, because we're seeing livestock discussions not be so villainized, but rather as a part of the solution.
So what is a favorite part of your day?
Favorite part of my day is definitely when I get to go out and walk through the feedlot pens and go drive through the cows and just see how they're doing, because it's important to, and unfortunately, my job is, I don't get to do that every day. My job is to do that about once a week, because it's being able to see the big changes that the guys who are out with them each and every single day will miss. But that's always the highlight of my week.
Nice. Sherry, I can't let you go without asking you about your Western town and backlot. It's it's so much better than having an Airbnb, as lots of farms or ranches do. You've got a whole town.
Because I have this horrible bad habit of loving my cows so much, sometimes I have to subsidize them with other entities or other sources of income. And it's actually more often than not. And we were very lucky back in the 90s to be approached from a film production company, because we do face the mountains. We have some very beautiful views here, viewscapes here that are unobstructed with anything. And it was the Lonesome Dove television series that came after the miniseries that were wanting to film a new series. And they came in and they would construct this town site if we would give them access to the lands. And it just grew from there. And so from that, we've over the years, we've had probably 50, 60 different television series, Hell on Wheels. I think that's one. Fargo has been done out here. We're getting all sorts of different new television series that come through here now. And it actually is an interesting concept, because there'll be days when there's anywhere from 200 to 500 people that will actually be on some of these sets. And it gives me an opportunity to be able to reach people that, like, especially if they're winter filming, for example. This is where the questions are, why aren't your cows in barns or things like that?
Or the
cows on a 20 below day, and have lots of questions. And it does give you the opportunity to be able to talk about what you're doing and talk about how you handle and manage the environment. And the interesting thing about the film industry is that the people that are a part of it are very appreciative of the ability to find places where they can operate and function freely. And in the cities, you don't get that. You're confined by your space and streets and people in the public. Here, they don't have that. So they're very protective of making sure that they don't negatively impact us either.
Oh, beautiful.
So it's a great relationship to have. And it's just been a lot of fun over the years, as we've seen some pretty big productions come through and some pretty small ones, too. I do worry about your American producers in the sense that they really don't understand what the sustainability, the round tables are about. And I think the most important message that I want them to know is that as producers, we are there to represent what's actually happening out in the field. And I think it's just a matter of having a little bit of faith in us. But at the same time, know that we are standing up for some of those issues that are a little tough to swallow because of whims of some of these corporations as well. And so please have some confidence. It takes time. It takes collaboration. It takes discussions. But we will get through this. And at the end of the day, we are, because, like I said, we are seeing livestock elevated once again to the important tool that they actually are in this system.
And then the last question I want to ask you is, what's your favorite steak?
My favorite steak? Ha, that's a good question, because I like them all. I mean, honestly, I think my favorite has got to be it's got to be a strip loin. I really, truly love those, and my husband has a wonderful way of cooking them on a smoker, and it's so good.
Oh, great. Josiah, making biochar is an ancient process, and now I can only imagine how today's technology can enhance that process. Can we start there?
Well, biochar has been part of soil development for as long as plant life and fire have coexisted, which, according to geological records, looks to be about 350 million years ago. It's a recalcitrant material, meaning it doesn't decay so quickly as when compared to like a wood chip, and therefore it exists in most all soils of the planet. It's hard to find soils without at least a little bit of charcoal in there, but it's surprisingly sneaky. It's kind of hard to find. Generally, you want to look at the soil organic matter or soil organic carbon. You'll usually do like a loss on ignition where they take a sample of soil and they dry it and then they burn it. And then the weight loss after burning, that was your organic matter, essentially. And that doesn't differentiate between the charcoal organic matter and the non-charcoal organic matter. So that would explain why it's kind of everywhere, yet hidden, and generally just kind of lumped together as the stuff that we know and love as organic matter, which the more we study it, the more complex we keep finding it is. And so, yeah, it's just a natural part of ecosystems and soil development. And humans are kind of a big part of that now, I guess. So starting thousands of years ago, when humans were tinkering around with agriculture, fire became a part of that as well. Fire and charcoal has long been tied to our agricultural practices in some form or another throughout most cultures throughout the world.
What you've been doing at Pacific Biochar, you're hooking up with biomass production plants, creating biochar, and then there's also co-benefits, which are literally worth mentioning here. Biochar has been with us forever, but let's go into the technology a little bit right now as far as what you're doing. Working with biomass production plants that are already set up is so brilliant that you've worked out a way to sort of hitch a ride, in a sense.
Yeah. I'm going to put a note on that. I'm going to actually take us a step back again. And so charcoal's been around. It's been some part of our agricultural practices, very notably in the Amazon, where there was vast areas of poor soil. Charcoal amendments in those soils had very good response, as well as being very noticeable because you have this huge, essentially blank slate of uniformly poor soil. So any amendments, any changes to that became very noticeable. And that helped clue scientists on that, hey, there's really something interesting. If we intentionally add charcoal to soils, we can get a very interesting and long-term response. And that was an important discovery. And then you got to kind of take the whole context in. So here we are in a world now where we have processing facilities handling biomass, resulting in piles of biomass so large we call it waste. Human activity has been so prolific, we've actually changed the atmosphere, which is in turn actually changing the climate of the planet that we inhabit, and in ways that have some pretty negative consequences if we look further down the road. And so with all that in mind, there was this idea that started forming, like, hey, we could take that waste biomass and transform it into charcoal, a process which is actually energy positive. It actually generates some electricity if we want to, and takes that carbon in the biomass and transforms it into a very stable form that can resist decay for hundreds, even thousands of years. And then we'll take that charcoal and bury it in the soil in a way that we can help improve long-term fertility, thus creating a waste management that is energy positive and removes carbon from the atmosphere, building the carbon reservoirs in the soil. So it's a pretty awesome cycle, you know, if you look at it holistically, and really became a powerful vision of what we can do using this as a climate change mitigation tool. And that vision, that idea, is why the word biochar exists. Because, you know, the word charcoal covers everything that biochar is. It's biomass charcoal. That's all it is. But that whole idea that we can mitigate climate change while dealing with waste management and leaving a legacy of fertile soil, that became so powerful that the word charcoal just couldn't hold it anymore. Uh-huh. So then what do we do? How do we do that? Like, cool story. Now, how do we actually put that into reality? And so that's been the hard part. And so you need a couple key things. One, you would need a carbon accounting system that can provide financial reward for carbon sequestered. That took a long time to develop. And that's one of the key developments. And that only happened recently in 2020. which helps explain the long, slow path of biochar development. In the meantime, we didn't waste any time. We've been trying to figure out how to produce this stuff efficiently, as efficiently as possible. You know, my company has been around since 2008. I started tinkering with biochar 2008, made a career out of it in 2009, and had to survive from 2009 till 2020 on ag sales alone, which caused us to be very effective at how we produce biochar. And after many different iterations of trying to make it as efficiently as possible, including making it by hand in my backyard for the first 5 years, kind of finally discovered this interesting opportunity where biomass power plants that exist today, some of them can be modified for biochar production. And this is great because they've already got trained staff, they've got equipment in place, all the utility connections, all the permits and contracts for biomass procurement and for energy sales, for selling electricity. And so it makes it really efficient to utilize some of that process and just modify the outcomes. And so there's some certain technologies that can be easily modified for biochar production. But then you have to still come up with a why. You know, sure, we can produce biochar, but then we need to, why would they produce biochar? Because every ton of biochar that we harvest is a ton of biochar they could have burned for energy. So we have to present a viable pathway that that biochar is actually worth more in the ground than it is in the furnace. You know, like, that's been the last, like, 15 years of my life is trying to make that statement true, that the biochar is worth more in the ground than it is in the furnace, proving that out through showing its value in agriculture and then helping pioneer the carbon markets so that we can get financial reward for the carbon that's put in the ground. And between the two of those, we're now able to make that true on a larger scale and able to be able to work with these biomass power plants and not just achieve the technical part of modifying the machinery a little bit, but now the financial part of being able to make it profitable for them to do that.
Yes. So there is an amazing amount of research that's just been blossoming, isn't there? And the benefits to the soil we're finding are maybe even more surprising than what we thought. And it's certainly a very good example of a regenerative system, both going sideways from what happens when you use it during biomass production, but also what you can use it for in the soil. And since we're concerned about regenerative ag here on Cultivated Audio, I'm wondering if you could start with the soil and how biochar benefits it. And maybe we can start with the microbes and what's behind biochar's support for the microbes.
I think the easiest way to think about it is that biochar is a part of what we already know and love as organic matter. It's a very stable part of what we know and love as organic matter. It can last for hundreds to thousands of years in the soil. You know, has many of the same benefits. Like if you put a list of the benefits of organic matter in soil, increasing soil tilth, increasing the ability of water to enter the soil and permeate through the soil, and improving the water availability to plants, improving soil aeration, which creates a better environment for the microorganisms, providing kind of a bank of nutrients and really helping with the whole nutrient management, nutrient exchange. You look at all these aspects, and biochar is kind of a parallel list of benefits to what we generally know and love as organic matter. There's a few key differences. One, that biochar organic matter is incredibly stable. I've already kind of mentioned that a couple times, and that's really key. One of the key differences, though, is that biochar is not edible for the microorganisms. You know, if you throw a wood chip in there, it's a food source, so certain fungi and bacteria will right away get to work on digesting that wood chip, and then through digesting that, they can make some of the minerals within it available to plants. Biochar is not digestible, so it's not going to be a source of nutrients itself, and it is not a source of food for your plants. Just like you can't break that cellulose apart and get the energy out of it. It's not cellulose anymore. It's transformed. And so biochar does differ from your non-biochar organic matter in that very distinct way that it is not digestible and therefore is not a direct food source for microorganisms. Though it does improve the ability of microorganisms to survive, to thrive, and to metabolize the food that is present.
I read that it also reduces the heavy metal toxins in plant tissue, which I guess just is part of all of what you were just talking about.
Yeah, that would be another distinction between biochar organic matter and non-biochar organic matter. Biochar organic matter is, especially when it's fresh and raw, is filter material. Charcoal is used in the filters. That's
right.
You know, a
yes.
lot of people are familiar with water filters, like, you know, like your kitchen, your countertop Brita water filter. They're generally using charcoal as one of the primary filter materials. And there's an interesting way. The biochar is incredibly high surface area, and the surface is generally adsorptive, meaning things will stick to it. Things will adhere to the surface of the biochar, and it's got an incredibly high surface area. So a lot of things will stick to the surface, and it's more or less indiscriminate. The biochar is more or less indiscriminate as to what sticks to its surface. But yet the biology of the soil tends to be a little bit more discriminate. And in that fashion, it helps to soak up elements. Elements in the soil will adhere to it. And then nitrogen, phosphorus, and the potassium and things like that that the plants and biota want, they can access that. They can pluck that off the biochar.
Mm.
You've got to work on it a little bit, but they can generally pluck it off the surface of the biochar without too much work.
Right.
But the things that are less desired just kind of stay sitting there. I guess I'm kind of anthropomorphizing like a little bit of how things work. The mechanisms get really tricky, but the results are pretty clear that the biochar works as a soil detox, kind of a filtration type material, that while plant nutrients such as nitrogen and phosphorus can adhere to the surface, adding biochar to soils does not seem to cause them to get irreversibly locked up. Whereas applying biochar to soils that have been contaminated with, you know, lead, mercury, arsenic, you know, some of your big hitter elements like that, you see a significant reduction in the plant uptake. You also see a significant reduction in the fatty tissues of earthworms that are in those soils. And in the leachate columns, if you were to do a soil leachate column. So you see in all ways that the adding the biochar reduces the bioavailability of these heavy metals. And similarly with toxic organic compounds, pesticides and herbicides are a great example. The biochar can help sponge those up. And this is an interesting way because then the biochar actually serves as a substrate where the microbes have a better chance of breaking that stuff down, you know, except for PFAS, the forever chemicals, they say. A lot of these toxic organic compounds can be broken down eventually. It just takes time and they need a little help. The surface of the biochar seems to help in most all cases with the biological degradation of some of these toxic organic compounds. So
wonderful.
Yeah,
yes. Yeah.
Pretty helpful.
Yes. And is the benefit of using compost and biochar together, is that some of those two parts larger than the two parts?
Sure seems to be. In fact, I use that analogy quite often. You know, going back to what I was saying earlier about how the biochar is a stable organic matter but is non-digestible. So including those both of those elements, a stable organic matter and a digestible organic matter, seems to work really, really well. And the biochar has another interesting characteristic in that it, particularly biochar, is produced at higher temperatures. They'll have electrical conductivity across short distance.
Love that.
And this is really important for the microbial metabolism. Because in order for microbes to do their magic, they've got to be able to move some electrons around. So having this material that can serve literally as a battery where the microorganisms can dump electrons and also gain electrons, as well as even a shuttle, electron shuttle over very short distances,
yes,
that really helps in the microbial metabolism of some of these more digestible organic matters. So they work great in concert. And then, of course, this really high surface area as a place to hold on to some of the resultant products of this metabolism, like organic acids. Organic acids and plant-available nutrients and some of the magical glues and stuff that microbes produce during their metabolism, these things tend to stick to the biochar surface, making it a much more functional product with a diverse surface covered in organic acids, humic acid, fulvic acid, and such, as well as plant-available nutrients and living organisms. Wow, you know, you get that organic film coating on the biochar, and it's great, and the biochar helps make the nutrients within the compost more efficient delivery system for the nutrients. And again, sometimes the exact mechanisms of why we get such great results when two are used together gets tricky, but the results have been consistent that biochar and compost used in combination generally tend to have significantly greater response than either one of them used alone. And like you're saying, the sum of either one of them used alone wouldn't add up.
I love what you're saying about the electrical component. That's a field of research that I just think is going to be growing and growing and growing. Joshua, I know you've developed something you call a biochar application rate calculator, and I'm wondering if you could tell us about this and lead into some of the nuts and bolts of how a farmer would get started using biochar as part of their farming protocols.
God, that's pretty out there. That's like inside baseball kind of stuff right there. Yes. It's been somewhat quiet. Like, we just use that internally mostly. I think we're looking at publishing it one time and then kind of held back. But I can say that I'm a board member with the United States Biochar Initiative as well. And I'm working with a few other board members to make a public version of the biochar application rate calculator, to make a public version that we're going to publish through the USBI website. And we're working on the details right now, particularly to help with the rollout of the new USDA NRCS Conservation Practice Standard 336. For soil carbon amendments. I don't know if you're aware of that one, but that's going to bring big money from the Farm Bill through the EQIP program, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program.
Wonderful.
For application compost, mulch, and biochar. Anyways, how we think about application rates for biochar. After dealing with this for quite a bit more than a decade here, figuring out how do we work with biochar, how does biochar work best? How do we get this to work best for the farmers? Because that's how we will survive or not. If it doesn't work for the farmers, it ain't gonna fly.
Right.
Nothing else is gonna happen. And so if we find success on one farm, how do we translate that into success on another farm? So I think it's really important to think of biochar in a three-dimensional application rather than a two-dimensional application. And specifically what I mean by that is that rather than only thinking about it in tons per acre, we must also consider tons per acre per depth. Right? So, mm-hmm. You know, you apply nitrogen, and the moment that nitrogen hits the soil, it's going to start moving around, right?
Right.
It can dissolve into some of the water, and it can then become part of the plant bodies and part of the fungal bodies and get transported throughout that soil. Apply a molecule of nitrogen in one place and find it in quite a different location as the seasons move around. That doesn't happen with biochar. You put the biochar on the ground, and that's where it's going to stay until it is physically moved by a worm or a gopher or a tractor. And so it's really important to think about it in a three-dimensional way. And at first I was kind of working a lot with percent by volume, and then that eventually evolved into percent organic matter equivalent, or especially for the NRCS program, we've kind of modified it to be now percent soil organic carbon equivalent. I know that's a lot. Just let me walk you through a quick couple steps further. We can look at the organic carbon content of a biochar material, and let's say that biochar is 85% organic carbon, and then we can look at the soil volume that we're cultivating. Say we're doing 100% of the acre and we're going 6 inches deep. We can calculate the mass of that. You know, how many tons is that?
Sure.
Using kind of some basic averages here. And then we can look at how many tons of biochar we're applying, how many tons of organic carbon are in that biochar, and what is the resultant change in soil organic carbon because of that application? And really, that's the number we know the most about, because biochar applications, looking at it like in this abstract form, like, well, I'm going to apply this many tons of biochar. What does that even mean? After years and years and years, I think really what it means is we just changed the organic carbon content in that area of soil by this much, right? And that's the number that seems to mean the most and is also the most transferable. And so usually what that'll end up looking like is a 0.5% change in the soil organic carbon content in the area that we've cultivated. So I know that gets pretty wild, because we always have to reduce that back to, because we actually have to deliver some tons per acre, right? But we use this calculator to check our math and see, like, does this make sense? We're going to change this soil carbon by 17% in the area cultivated. Heck no, that doesn't make sense. Something's wrong with the application rate here. And then we go back and we look at the calculator. Okay, we're going to change the soil organic carbon by 1% in the area cultivated that works, that fits within the paradigms that we understand with organic carbon and with changes to soil, and that works. That's an application rate that makes sense. I'll approve that. Like, for instance, we have a client that's doing vineyards. We've done a lot of work with them, and they found an application rate that works really, really well. Their vine rows are 2 feet wide and 9 foot on center and 3 feet deep. That's how deep they go for the pre-plant. So 3 feet deep by 2 feet wide and 22% of the field, 10 tons per acre, worked out to be about 0.4% soil organic carbon in the area cultivated. We can take that application rate and transfer it to any number of different fields that might have a slightly different cultivation practice, right? Say maybe a different field, they're only going 2 feet deep. Well, we can take that 0.4% soil organic carbon application rate that works so well and figure out how many tons of biochar do they need to achieve that.
As you were talking earlier, what came to my mind was, well, what about a farmer who doesn't do till? So they don't want to dig everything up and put biochar 2 or 3 feet down. Can you put it out on your fields and put compost over that and go from there? Is it necessary to dig things up?
No, we're working with some no-till farmers also. There's a big project that we're helping provide some biochar from. They're doing a bunch of research in no-till. And for the no-till farming, we're just looking at low application rates incrementally applied. So small applications of biochar in a few different applications. So what that might look like is kind of a dusting of biochar lightly spread across the acreage after harvest when there's all the stubble still in the field to help kind of capture the biochar that we throw out there.
You mentioned you worked with vineyards. Are there other types of farming that this would benefit more than other types of farming, or just straight across the board adding all this carbon? I mean, it certainly seems like a good thing to me, a wise thing.
Yeah. Well, there's a few elements to what you're talking about here. So one, just putting the carbon in the ground is great. Or from a climate change mitigation standpoint, get the carbon in the ground. You know, sure, we can accomplish that with pretty much any soil. But if you're looking at plant growth response, generally, the worse the soil, the better the response.
Of course, yes.
You know, it's pretty much that easy. Specifically, if your soil is a very coarse, sandy soil that might suffer from lack of ability to hold on to water, the biochar is going to dramatically improve the water-holding capacity in the coarse, sandy soils. If your soil is a heavy clay soil that might suffer from compaction and difficulty for water penetration and difficulty for plant available water, then the biochar can really help in all those cases as well by helping improve the tilth in that soil, which will reduce some of the compaction, improve the permeability or infiltration of water, as well as help make the water that's held within those soils more plant available. But if you got that perfect loam, the biochar's got a heavier hill to climb as far as providing significant plant growth response. Generally, if you've got a perfect loam with high organic matter, that would be in the lowest response category, if that makes sense.
It totally makes sense. And I think it would make sense to do that light application, right? Because it would enhance, it would, as we spoke about earlier, the compost and the biochar combination.
Yeah, in the soils that are already great, generally we kind of switch the paradigm. So there's often two ways to look at biochar applications providing benefit. One is, my soil's junk, let's go to the root of the problem and improve the soil. Or, my soil's great, but perhaps we can improve the efficacy of the inputs that I'm adding. And so in that case, if your soil is already awesome, biochar can still be very useful at improving the efficacy of your compost and or fertilizer applications.
Wonderful. So Josiah, is there something you'd like to add in before we close today?
Yes, thank you for asking. It was on my mind earlier and I forgot to bring it up. And that's the relationship between biochar organic matter in your soil and the non-biochar organic matter in your soil. How does biochar influence the accumulation of organic matter? And now that we've got more than 20,000 research articles with biochar now, and we've got years of data to look at, field trials more than 10 years old, the overwhelming evidence shows that the biochar additions to soil helps increase the accumulation of organic matter where applied, which is a big deal in some situations where the biochar can basically shift that equilibrium to a higher point.
No kidding.
Yeah. And well, that's an important one because it can be yes. somewhat counterintuitive. I was mentioning earlier how the biochar can, in some cases, improve the metabolization of microorganisms.
Yes.
So you might take that one step further and imagine that if you applied biochar to your soils, it would just cause the microorganisms to metabolize all other organic matter. Mm-hmm. I think that's a valid concern, but that's not what the evidence has shown. The evidence has shown quite the contrary. Where the biochars have been applied, the result is a greater accumulation of organic matter.
Mm, I love it.
And moisture content, I'd say, biochar is pretty lightweight material. And if it's dry, it can become a nuisance and even a hazard. So it's important to keep biochar wet. Most producers will try to make sure that they provide a properly moistened product. But then if you're making it yourself or if you're going to be storing it for any amount of time, you've got to consider what management you're going to do. Either keep it moist or keep it covered. If it's out in the sun and the wind, it can literally dry out and blow away. I've literally seen a pile, two-thirds of a truckload, blown away in the wind, just completely blown away into the neighbor's yard.
We're quite fortunate, aren't we, to have so much great information shared by folks like Sherry Copathorn Barnes and Josiah Hunt. Archives and information are at cultivatedaudio.com, and podcasts are streaming in the usual places. Until next month, this is Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make Here Where We All Want to Be.